Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. I'm really looking forward to this one. I get to work with Zach today. Zach, tell us who have we got on.
So today we are going to have another episode essentially about the Troubles in Northern Ireland. Folks might remember that we were talking about this a few weeks back, and today we have Aaron Edwards on. We're very fortunate to have him here. He's a senior lecturer in Defence and International Affairs at the Royal Military Academy of Sandhurst. And he's also a published author of a number of books, including UVF, Behind the Mask, and Mad Mitch's Tribal Law, Aidan and the End of Empire. But his most recent book, Agents of Influence, Britain's Secret Intelligence Against the IRA, is going to be the focus of what we're talking about today. Aaron, great to have you here. How are you doing?
I'm very well. It's good to be here with both of you today.
I'm so excited. I'm so excited because, I've grown. You've grown up with this, but I get to actually talk about it today, and I get to learn something. So I'm really looking forward to this. Okay, so for people like me, before we start talking about your book and the secret life of the secret agents, can you give our listeners, because we have many listeners from around the world who might not know a lot about the topic, a bit of an overview of the situation in Northern Ireland and why the troubles began.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, where do you begin? Often with Irish history, people want to know your background before you start speaking about it. So, I mean, I'm from there, from a troubled part of the world, from Belfast. Although I've been living in England since 2008, I've been working here, and I've been working with the military. So, I suppose my background and my upbringing really influence how I see the conflict in Northern Ireland and where I pinpoint the kind of origins to. A lot of people would see the present troubles as beginning in the late 1960s. Others, because it's quite fashionable at the moment to look back to, 100 years ago and partition of Ireland. You could go back several hundred years. I mean, it's really entirely up to you. But again, as I've said, it depends on where you are. Looking at this, what your vantage point is, where you're from, your narrative will change according to those biographical details. So I'm quite comfortable talking about the troubles from the late 1960s onwards because that's my area of expertise. But of course, I have written about the longer period in Irish history, and so really, I can begin and end this story wherever you like.
Well, so let's take it all the way, way, way back to, I mean, do you want to take it back as far as Cromwell even? Because you could make an argument that it goes back to that or potentially even further.
Yeah, so you can go back hundreds of years. You can go back to Strongbow in Ireland. You can go back to Cromwell in the and when the plantations prior to Cromwell, the plantations in Ireland really saw the sort of settlement of that, particularly the Ulster, the ancient province of Ulster, by those merchants and those people who were involved in business who came to Ireland and sort of set up shop. And then you have the sort of inevitable clash between the two tribes, as it were. It's a conflict that can be portrayed in many ways: settlers versus natives, or indeed, planters versus Gaels. But really, the origins of the conflict, I think, are less important than really the durability of the conflict between the people there. So there are all sorts of external kind of actors involved, Britain and the British Empire much later. But essentially that quarrel between the two different tribes has grown considerably since the 17th century, and has had all sorts of permutations throughout recent history over the past few hundred years, and I think is integral really to the debate today about where Ireland sits in relation to the European Union and Britain's exit from the European Union. So Ireland has never been far from the history books or indeed from the news headlines. That idea of looking back through the mists of time is interesting and intriguing to me as a historian, but I think I'm much more of a contemporary historian. I'm looking at the longer roots, but I think that, as I've said, the quarrel there is very much part of my DNA when I go back when I can to Ireland, north and south. I spend a lot of time on the island, and I speak to people who from different perspectives and different traditions, and we all have different ways of looking at the history, but the past is very much the present, particularly in Northern Ireland today.
With that in mind, when you're writing, are you conscious of the potential for what you're saying to generate a bit of a backlash and for people to react in incredibly strong terms to this? Because it's not like many historiographical debates where we're talking about things that are long since past. And, I can have heated debates about Napoleonic stuff and nobody's really that fussed because everything's long since past. This, as you say, it is very current. It's very present. Do you experience a backlash sometimes with what you write?
Absolutely. I'm not sure if it's me that they take issue with or what I've written. I mean, you can separate the two. I'm quite an easygoing kind of person. I have friends from all around the world, and all different backgrounds. I'm interested actually in things beyond Ireland. I teach an international security studies course. I'm fascinated by conflict between people, wherever that arises. And but because I speak with the Northern Irish accent, and I must have a position. So it's very ideologically charged, and I think it's also political. People then sort of try to tether you to one side of that spat or another, and that's incredibly difficult. I think that you have to always have a very thick skin. I mean, I tend not to take it personally because actually it's a rejection of one view over another, and people are perfectly entitled to have these different views, whatever informs them, politics, socioeconomic position in society, whatever it might be, ethnicity, religion, whatever floats your boat. And so, but yes, absolutely. I mean, people then they see you as like an effigy, really, that they rally around to try and burn. On occasion, and it's quite interesting because actually I try not to give people too much fuel, but unfortunately, fortunately for me, I think my books attract kind of media interest, and so once the media gets hold of it, you get that kind of tabloid sensationalism, and where they really focus in on one aspect, and really leave out the kind of rest of the story. And what I'm trying to do really is trying to put across a kind of alternative history, if you like, one that could be acceptable to all right-thinking men and women, rather than just simply, one side or the other. So I think that my own kind of historical training, from being a student and then beyond that, I look to the work of Erik Hobsbawm and people like that who had, written from below, rather than, the kings and queens and the great men, usually very, very rarely women at the top. And so I'm very interested in how, ordinary people kind of see these events unfolding, these great, cataclysmic, historical events. So that's why I offer something a little bit different. And it can actually be one of those occasions when, your work is picked up and read by lots of people, where you're like Marmite all of a sudden, people either love you or they hate you. Rather than, yeah, that's fine. I learned something new.
So let's move on to your book because I was quite drawn into this book, and it's a really interesting topic. So what did the intelligence war set out to do, and what was its purpose?
So at the beginning of the conflict in the late 1960s, the present conflict, the Troubles as they've become euphemistically known, it was very much for the UK and the deployment of the British military in 1969, a sort of peacekeeping role. And then that very quickly turned overnight into an offensive war against British troops and police by the Provisional IRA particularly, but also the official IRA. So the Irish republicanism has split throughout history, and so the most prominent group, the Provisional IRA, were emerging fast, emerging in the early 1970s, a really determined kind of ruthless threat to not only British troops and security forces in Northern Ireland, but also to the British mainland, the UK mainland. And so there was a, you know, there was a series of decisions taken that, you know, the intelligence services really had to up their game and improve the intelligence picture. So they had to have like a kind of understanding, not only of what was happening there, the conflict between people, but also, you know, who was involved in these groups, you know, how did they organize themselves? What were they doing? What were they planning? And the only way really of getting that information, apart from, you know, intercepting phone calls and so on, tapping phone calls, as we see in other theaters of the Cold War, we also see the insertion of human intelligence sources. So agents inside these groups, and also the turning of members of these groups to become informants. So really the intelligence war is a kind of multi-pronged attack. You know, you've got like signals intelligence, you've got image intelligence, people take photographs of people meeting other people, and you know, satellite imagery and so on, even though it was in its infancy then in the 1970s. And then of course you have the human eyeball, you know, getting eyes on what's happening, the discussions that are happening in smoke-filled rooms.
One of the things you touch on, I believe, in your book is this kind of idea of sowing paranoia amongst the paramilitary groups, so that they're kind of looking over their shoulder the whole time, thinking that agents were everywhere. How do they go about attempting to do that in practice? Because that's quite a difficult thing to do operationally, not least because if you have assets on the ground who are feeding you intelligence, you can't afford to compromise those assets. So how do they go about trying to do it, and ultimately does it work?
Yeah, so the strategy originates actually from the Second World War. So J.C. Masterman had written about, you know, this double cross system, and that was used in wartime, and you know, the sort of I guess the conclusion of that was that in order to frustrate the sort of German spy ring in England, you had to then feed them kind of half-truths, lies. You had to manipulate them in some way, and you also had to essentially be in charge of that spy ring, even though they thought that they were running their own spy ring against the English and the British. They were actually being manipulated through various means. And so they took that kind of template, and by the 1970s, when the Northern Ireland Troubles are at their height and hundreds of people are losing their lives, they're actually trying to do two things. So the direct approach is to find out that information that I talked about, but also they have to realise that in Northern Ireland, in Ireland, it's a very different place. And from the Second World War, it's a very different place that Britain understands from its empire. So a lot of these techniques are used in various places, in South Yemen in the late 1960s, and, you know, in Cyprus in the 1950s and so on. But in Ireland, they realized that the only way really you're going to get through and break down the kind of walls, the barriers that the IRA and other terrorist groups have erected is if you get right inside that movement. And because the movement is connected through family ties, what you're really asking people to do is not betray some ideological cause. You're asking them to betray their friends and their family. And so one way of doing that very effectively, it's still in operation, this network of the rumour mill in Belfast. I also lived in Derry, Londonderry, for a year before I moved to England. And I can see it there. You can start a rumour very easily, and it kind of travels through. It's almost like a virus-like, you know, it spreads. It can get out of control, and it becomes an echo chamber. So this is really before Twitter, before social media, you have a kind of network in place, and spreading that, it can be used directly or indirectly. So you essentially engineer the demise of individuals. You move them from one position to another. And unfortunately, in the Irish conflict, you know, can lead to them being killed by their own comrades. So it's very murky. It's been referred to as a dirty war, but it's a very murky way of essentially keeping your opposition, your terrorist opposition, off balance.
I'm really interested. You mentioned the types of agencies that were involved, or the types of departments that were involved in the intelligence war. I want to know and dig a little bit deeper in this. Was it all just revolving around MI5 at this point, or have you got other agencies that are being pulled in to be able to work collectively?
So the principal agencies involved are the military and the police, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, and the security service MI5. Now, there is a sort of interagency cooperative unit set up between MI5 and MI6 called the Irish Joint Section. And the Irish Joint Section is really where you have agent handlers and also intelligence officers of different, technical capabilities involved in Ireland North and South, because this becomes quickly an international issue. I mean, it's damaging the UK's reputation on the world stage to a certain extent, and the IRA are very aware of that. And in fact, their propaganda is referred to quite simply as propaganda of the deed. So they are very well aware of that. They've got a very good receptive audience in the United States and Irish America, and in other places. And so it becomes a battle then for legitimacy between the British government and the IRA. And so that would involve the Foreign Intelligence Service, Britain's Foreign Intelligence Service, MI6, to a lesser extent. But really, when we're talking about the kind of frustration of IRA operations on a day-to-day basis, that's stopping gunmen from going out and shooting soldiers or police officers or blowing up civilians or whatever it might be. That job is handed to the local police service, the Royal Ulster Constabulary. So they run most of the agents at the time. And in my interviews, when I interviewed some of their former senior officers, they said that 90%, 95%, something like that, 99%, one said, of all the agents inside terrorist groups are being handled by the police. So, but then you do have this dimension of agents of influence, which is the title of my book, where you have political agents, people who are essentially either inserted in or turned, and their role is simply to move in the context of the IRA, move its political wing in a direction where it wins votes. And so the theory goes, because it's been applied in different theatres for the UK and different parts of the world and its empire, you're shoring up the moderates and you're sidelining the extremists. So the idea, the rationale is that at some point in the future, the moderates will become the most important dominant part of that Irish Republican movement. In fact, that's what happens by the 1990s.
So, is there an equivalent movement by the IRA to, generate their own intelligence and also to counter what the British and MI5 and the police force are doing, but then also insert their own agents to spread their own disinformation where they can?
Absolutely. So the Provisional IRA as a guerrilla army, as a terrorist group, as an insurgent group, whatever way you want to characterize it, of course they would see themselves as freedom fighters. So within all freedom fighter type organizations, you have this ability to engage in counterintelligence. So the IRA's counterintelligence relies on individuals being very good at, well, first of all, being trustful. They are trustworthy, sorry. They are there. They are long-standing Republican figures, and they are considered to be what the IRA or former IRA members would refer to as beyond reproach. Okay, so you have figures that loom large in the Provisional IRA, like Brendan Hughes. Brendan Hughes is a senior IRA man. He spends some time in prison, of course. He's captured, and he spends the 1980s in prison. Then he's released. He becomes responsible for tracking down those moles, closing in on informants, and outing agents. And he's frustrated in that because the people who are in place doing that are rumored to actually be British agents themselves. So what you see there is the IRA's counterintelligence operation actually being run by the British. So and that takes a long, long time to get to that point. And of course, not everybody in the IRA is working for the British, but some people are, and that kind of influence that you can have in misdirecting the IRA is very, very important. So it is a very murky war. I think that the counterintelligence extends from hunting down these moles, and they are executed, by the way. Over 70 people were murdered by the IRA, accused of treason, men and women, I should add. But also, Brendan Hughes is involved in a very sophisticated signals intelligence operation. And he's also party to human intelligence, that where IRA leaders have actually turned police officers, and to an extent military and former military, where they are feeding them information. So there's an alternative history and narrative there of where the parachute regiment, the fearsome British Army unit, which is of course in the news at the moment, is very aggressive on the streets. But there are some members of the parachute regiment who joined the Provisional IRA and are feeding them information, and not only that, they're helping to construct bombs, they're helping to carry out attacks. I mean, you know, so their sympathies could lie and did lie with the Irish and with the Irish Republican Army. So that's why you do get a kind of a clash between those spy masters and those people within the IRA who try to, you know, push back. And I think by the late 1980s, the British are definitely in the ascendancy in terms of this fight with the IRA. And by the early 1990s, those individuals like Brendan Hughes are not sidelined necessarily in the early 1990s. He's actually promoted. So by the sort of mid-1990s, he's very senior. So he's no longer responsible for the day-to-day, mole hunt. And then, of course, he is sidelined because he walks away from Sinn Féin and the Republican movement, because he doesn't believe that where they've taken the IRA is the right, you know, the right path. And so he's a very central figure in all of this. And I know that, having interviewed senior police officers who were in the RUC special branch, they handle the agents, they saw him as probably the one individual who could have turned the tide on them. They saw him as a very worthy opponent, and they could never ever turn someone like him, and that's why it was, you know, a constant cat or mouse game.
So we had a podcast with Andrew Lowney a couple of months ago, where we ended up talking about the Mountbatten assassination in 1979. And one of the intelligence officers you actually discuss in your book, he was actually brought out of retirement in the aftermath of the tragedy, of Morris Oldfield. Can you talk to us a little bit about him and what role he played in the intelligence war?
Morris Oldfield was the former chief of the Secret Intelligence Service, MI6, and he was a very senior intelligence official for many years, and he retired in 1978. He became a research fellow at All Souls in Oxford, and then in 1979 he's chosen as a security and intelligence coordinator at Stormont. The reason why he's chosen is because, well, he's not the first choice. What Mrs. Thatcher, Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister, wants in the aftermath of the assassination of Lord Mountbatten and the 18 soldiers at a place called Warren Point, very, very close to the Irish border, on the same day, is she wants better intelligence, but she also wants someone who's an ambassador type figure who can improve relations between Britain and Ireland, because there is no cooperation to speak of really between the Gardaí, the forces, and the law enforcement agencies in the south, and the British Army and police and so on in the north. So the first choice is actually a former ambassador. He's not available. The second choice isn't available either. So the third choice, it falls to the former most senior British intelligence officer in the UK. And he's reluctant to take the job because he knows that Ireland is a difficult and dangerous place. Even though he is a single man, he has an older family. And he has a family, a sort of extended family that he lives with, like sisters, and he's worried about them. He's worried about people who are closely associated with them, that the IRA might target them. But he then sees it as his duty to come over to Belfast. And what he does is he essentially It was described to me as he held people's hands while they made changes that were necessary in order to get better intelligence on the IRA. And he is unfortunately not in the post very long. A scandal removes him from his position as security and intelligence coordinator. Having said that, he does lay the foundations that quickly become the most effective intelligence attack against the IRA yet seen, probably since the 1950s when there was an IRA border campaign and another senior MI5 officer, Bill Maggin, had gone over to Belfast and had assisted the RUC in trying to, you know, stop those IRA attacks. So it is a significant period, I think, in the Troubles. What he does is he lays a foundation 10 years later, this plan that he originally devised and helped to formulate comes to fruition. He's replaced, incidentally, by a senior Foreign Office official, Rooks Richards, who's very famous for being an SOE agent runner in France in the Second World War. And then he becomes an ambassador after the war in various places. Brooks Richards is absolutely committed to continuing with what they call the old field system. And that's what I look at, certainly in the first few chapters of my new book.
So less than a year after Mountbatten's assassination, the British begin operations to arrest and then neutralise the IRA kind of in the process. I'm curious about what you wrote in your book about Operation Artichoke. And the way in which it's involving, I think I've got this right, teams in Belfast, but also in London. Give us a sense about both the intelligence gathering process behind that, but then also how the operation as a whole plays out.
So Operation Artichoke is one of the first joint operations between the police, army and MI5 against the IRA. It's the first major intelligence attack. It's not the only one. There are surveillance operations referred to in history books and in my book as Operation Hawk, which is targeting like the quartermaster who's in charge of the guns and explosives in the IRA in Belfast, Brian Keenan. He's then arrested. It's really about tracking the senior leaders, finding out what they are up to. And it's a rudimentary kind of early attempt at movements or traffic analysis where you find out not only where they're going, but who they're speaking to, and you kind of put all the jigsaw pieces together, and that gives you a better intelligence picture. So Artichoke's actually where you bring in special forces, or where the British brought in special forces for the first time, and they have a reputation as being somewhat, ruthless in the arrest and detention, or indeed the killing of some of the terrorists. But actually, they're relatively new to, the urban operational theatre of Belfast themselves. They've been operating mainly in South Armagh and the countryside, conducting, you know, again, surveillance and interdiction operations against the IRA. So in that period, what you have actually in Belfast is you have this fairly straightforward arrest operations. They arrest the IRA M60 gang there, because that's a weapon that they use. It's a Vietnam War era kind of heavy machine gun, and they are targeting police and military patrols. So the special forces are part of a wider operation to close the net on the IRA and then capture them. But unfortunately, the operation goes wrong, and one of the young officers, Richard Westmacott, he is killed when they raid the house. But the IRA M60 gang, they surrender, and about a year later they break out of prison, and so go on the run. But they are captured at that time. It's seen as a success, and it's actually announced by the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland in the House of Commons as this great success, an example of the police, military, and intelligence agencies working together. What's also interesting is it's happening at the same time as probably one of the most famous raids in the UK's military history, and that is the Iranian embassy siege in London, where a sister unit of that unit that's at work in Belfast is mounting an operation against the hostage takers in London. So you know, it's there are two examples, two operations are running concurrently that introduce really the SAS, Special Air Service, to the world's media and the rest of the world. So that in my book, I look at the operation in detail because I was fortunate enough to interview someone who was involved in the Operation Artichoke, and I was just very interested in that relationship that was developing between the police and the army primarily, but also with intelligence service support.
I'm quite interested, like you, in the day-to-day people, the average Joe, the Bob on the street. So for me, I want to know a little bit more about the agents that were recruited within the IRA. Were there many of them? Do we know much about them and the conditions that they had to operate under? And most of all, the one thing I think everybody is dying to know is, were they given free rein to commit crimes as agents?
The agents and the sources that I talked to were very ordinary people, and they belonged to that community of the nationalist community, the Republican community. Two of them in particular that I interviewed belonged to that community. They were chosen, they were recruited because they could easily move within that community without drawing any attention. So there are different ways that you can draw attention as a spy. One, you might talk with a different accent. So, for example, when I lived in Derry in 2007, 2008, anytime I opened my mouth, okay, people instantly knew I wasn't from the city. So that's a giveaway. So the accent can be a giveaway. Your community background can betray you. If you're in a divided society, it can betray you very, very quickly. Not just through the way that you talk, but the way that you think, the way that you act, just the way that you are, your entire demeanor. Plus, also because it's a very small place, we're only talking about 1.5 million people at that time. 30 years ago, it's grown the population since then. But it was referred to as some British Army officers as a village, and in villages, everybody knows everybody's business, right? So that's why they were carefully chosen, because they could hide in plain sight. One of the very interesting aspects of this intelligence history that I've been looking at recently is I've gone back into some of the classics, like Kim Philby's My Silent War. He was a very famous double agent of KGB, and then he eventually escaped. He went off to Moscow to live out the rest of his life as a traitor. But what he talks about is a cover personality, so that, in order to reconcile the difficult business of spying on your own people, your own kind, you have to develop an entire personality and change your personality and become them. So you become what you are sent in to betray. So one of the agents that I interviewed, Willie Carlin, his sister was in the IRA, and she was intimately involved in IRA operations in the 1970s. He was recruited by MI5 in 1974. Whilst he was a serving British soldier, he was demobilized. He was then sent back to Derry to spy on the IRA, and spy on his own sister, and spy on people that she had come into contact with. So really, you get a very ground level up view of IRA operations. So he's feeding political intelligence at that time, which is quite important. And for MI5 particularly, who had recruited him, to know what was going on. But there's a famous saying in Northern Ireland particularly, which is that the dogs in the street know, and the dogs in the street are very intelligent, and they pick up all sorts of chatter. And so Willie Carlin was essentially an echo chamber. Everything he picked up, he then passed back, and that's how they did it. So he was simply there as a passive vessel, collecting information as a channel of information for London, and that found its way into various kind of operational intelligence reports. And again, from 1981, after the IRA hunger strikes, or while they were ongoing, he then re-engaged. He had walked away in 1980 from the IRA, or sorry, from the reporting on the IRA and Republican activities, and he was paid off as an agent. He was retired as an agent, and then he sort of re-engaged. And the reason why he re-engaged is a young woman was murdered point blank range in front of him in a street, and then he went to work for British military intelligence until 1985 when he was withdrawn. But he was a political agent. There are, you know, another agent that I spoke to had been involved in the fringes of IRA activity, and I interviewed him on a number of occasions and found that he was a very different person. He was also tasked with a very difficult job of actually infiltrating into IRA squads and bringing back information. And he found it very difficult actually to remain passive. And so he was often bounced into operations at the time. As we would say in Belfast, you bounced into things, press ganged would be another way of putting it. And so he found himself actually witnessing some of the military activities. In terms of whether they were authorized, they weren't authorized to engage in violent activity. They were simply there. And I've interviewed the former spy masters from the police, and they've said under no circumstances were they to get involved. Having said that, it was a grey area. They told me it was a grey area because you can't have someone infiltrated into or turned within a paramilitary organization who isn't going to become engaged in that sort of activity, simply because they would be then there would be shadows of doubt. There would be an attempt to work out whether they were indeed an agent by having them participate in some activities. And if they didn't participate, then they were seen as a traitor and they could have been executed. So this is a sort of very dangerous territory that they had found themselves operating in.
How much support do these agents get on a sort of day-to-day basis? Are they just kind of cast adrift, or is there some kind of mechanism for safeguarding them? Because, I mean, if they're in the field, what can you honestly do to field in inverted commas, but what can you honestly do to support them?
When we look at this, I think we have to look at the past as almost a different, you know, country, because today they've all sorts of gadgets and technology that they can use, at least a mobile phone, which was not available when we're talking about the 1980s, even the early 1990s. I mean, they do come in, but some of these sources had to use public telephones in order to get the word out. Sometimes public telephones were vandalized. Sometimes they were literally blown up. They were firebombed, petrol-bombed. They were damaged in civil disturbances. So it's a very hostile environment, a non-permissive environment for them to carry out their day-to-day activities. Very nerve-wracking, I think, for them. And one of the dimensions that I look at is a psychological dimension, the human dimension. You know, you've got people here who are literally risking their lives, could be carried out the back door of their homes and shot. I mean, I grew up in a place in a very kind of tough neighborhood where I saw people shot. I actually saw people shot. I saw people fight. I saw people, you know, shots were fired. Heavy weaponry like AK-47s were carried around. I mean, it was almost like a war zone from what we would see in other places today. Back then, that's what we're dealing with. Context is very important. So I think that they are operating in that hostile environment, and it's a very tricky set of circumstances for them.
So do you think, I mean, you've probably been asked this question about a million times, we're going to ask it anyway. So do you think that the British intelligence contributed to the stalemate that eventually led to the Good Friday Agreement? And do you think that the intelligence war was successful in what they set out to do?
That's a great question. I think that the idea of a stalemate developing is a very convenient way for us to look at it, looking back in history. And why I say that is that the Provisional IRA was brought to what intelligence officers call a culminating point in the early 1990s, By the mid-1990s, I mean 1994, when they call the ceasefire, they were in a position where they could go on no further. So I've interviewed former senior members of Sinn Féin, and they've said, well, what was the IRA to do? Was the IRA to continue for 25 years? Or, in their words, could we cash in the chips of the armed struggle? So they thought that they could get more of their overarching political aim, which was British out of Ireland, Ireland reunited. They could get more through politics, and so there are academics who argue very strongly that this politicisation is the best way to explain it. That the IRA didn't win necessarily, but it didn't lose either, and so some people have taken that to be a stalemate. But what you have going on at that time, actually, it's not just British intelligence and the Provisional IRA. You have loyalist paramilitary groups that are they're killing a heck of a lot of Republicans and ordinary people, Catholics primarily. So it's a sectarian war that's going on there too, and that's very worrying for British intelligence because they're talking to Republicans, and at the same time, these loyalist paramilitaries, these Protestant paramilitaries who are against the IRA, are killing them and literally trying to set them up for assassination. And so I've interviewed in my previous book, I interviewed loyalist paramilitaries who had been on what they call operations, where they were sent out to assassinate Martin McGuinness, who was the chief of staff of the IRA. Well, actually, he was Northern Commander in the early 1990s, the operational commander for the IRA. So if they'd assassinated him, then who knows where the peace process would have gone, because he was the one that they were talking to most. And Gerry Adams, he was also rumored to have been up for assassination by loyalist paramilitaries. They were on the hunt for him in the 1980s, long into the 1990s. So those operations had to be frustrated as well. So I think what you have is rather than a fast flowing stream, a river, where it's just the British intelligence services, the British government, and the IRA. You also have all these little tributaries. You've all these little kind of streams running into that fast flowing peace process river, if you like, and so they also have to be talked into, accepting some kind of peace. And in 1984, when you get the mainstream paramilitary organizations on both sides calling a halt to their armed campaign. It's at that time war weariness, the idea of stalemate has grown. But I think later on, when the IRA fully decommissioned and end their war in 2005, strategically, they are boxed into a position where they accept what's known as the principle of consent. So they accept the fact that unionists have a right to be in Ireland and in charge of their own destiny. So I think that it's we must see more than simply those two players in the game. And but British intelligence, was it significant in gathering that secret information in order to frustrate IRA operations? Absolutely. Did it play a role in moving the IRA towards politics? Definitely. And is it responsible, the only thing responsible for ending the Troubles? No, definitely not.
Aaron, this has been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us. I have one last question, I guess, which is we see a lot of this still in the news for very obvious reasons. Most famously, most prominently at the moment, the actions of SAS troops opening fire on civilians. How fragile is the situation right now? Because we see a lot in the media about how the tensions are increasingly coming to the fore within the last sort of 18 months or so. Do you have a perception that this is still a very kind of volatile and fragile situation out there in Northern Ireland?
Sure. So the incident you were referring to, the Ballymurphy shootings by the Parachute Regiment, a regular army unit, against people in the Ballymurphy area of Belfast, West Belfast. I think that that's again an example of how the past always haunts the political present and has a tendency. These events were 50 years ago. This is not ancient history for people. This is recent history. It might as well have happened yesterday. And so tensions are always on the boil, whether it's one community or the other, or indeed when both of them enter into this kind of It's been referred to as a sham fight, but where they really try to get one over on each other, because what this is from an academic point of view is a zero-sum conflict. It's an ethnic conflict, an ethno-national division that's strong and permeates all aspects of Northern Ireland. It's not to say it's the future, because we know that people also have different views and different political identities and so on, different ambitions, just want to live a normal life. But in some of these areas where it is endemic, this quarrel, you do not get the movement towards a more fruitful, positive peace. And so, unfortunately, I think the fragility of the peace process will continue, and it will continue for all sorts of reasons that we probably haven't time to talk about. But I think that the what happened in the past is something that is not entirely understood and is actually weaponized by one side or the other. And unfortunately, as long as you are in that scenario where people aren't looking to the future to live together and to say, never again will we return to those dark days, then the conflict will continue to relapse and it will become violent at certain times. And I think we're in that eye of the storm right now. We saw in early April the beginnings of this, and I think that it's by no means over, sadly, and I can report that from the front line, and where I will be returning in a few weeks' time to see just what the pandemic has done in terms of moving things forward. I think certainly that the pandemic that we see is just another example where initially we saw people work together and then they pulled apart. So I don't think the pandemic has brought people together. In fact, sadly, I think that the quarrel, lives long in the hearts and minds of the people there, regardless of whether there is a health crisis or a climate emergency or whatever that might be. We still have the intractable conflict there.
Aaron, this has been so insightful. I'm so glad you came on and talked to us about this. I've learned so much. I mean, literally, this is recent history. This is, and it's still ongoing, just like Zach said. Ladies and gentlemen, make sure you do head to our online bookshop as well to grab yourself a copy. Just going to remind you of the title, Agents of Influence, Britain's Secret Intelligence War Against the IRA. And thank you again for joining us, Aaron.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
You can help us at History Hack by joining us via Patreon. It takes quite a lot of effort and a lot of work of quite a big team now to keep us going. And so if you could donate as little as £3 a month, it would be massively appreciated by all of us. There's different levels because Princess Marcus has set it all up with varying rewards and things. So do have a look, do join us. There's an exclusive Facebook group as well, and you could be part of all of it.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hackhistory, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.